This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
If I asked you to picture authentic Korean food, you'd probably immediately imagine those bubbling, fiery red stews.
Oh, yeah. Or like heavily marinated short ribs sizzling on a grill.
Exactly. I mean, we tend to associate the cuisine with these bold, aggressive flavors that just grab your attention right away.
It's a very specific expectation.
But today, we are doing a deep dive into a classic Korean dish that honestly flips that entire script. We're looking at a culinary project that contains absolutely zero spice.
None at all.
Right, and it completely skips the traditional meat or seafood in its base. Plus, it requires like the careful precision of a clockmaker to keep it from just exploding into a cloudy, starchy mess.
It really is the ultimate deceptive dish. I mean, it looks incredibly simple in the bowl, but the execution is where the true art lies.
Yeah.
You're trying to capture a very delicate texture, and that requires, well, a level of mindfulness you don't always associate with just throwing together a pot of soup.
So welcome to this deep dive. If you're listening, you're likely a curious home cook outside of Korea, you know, someone who loves exploring global flavors in your own kitchen, but wants to understand the actual mechanics behind the meals.
Absolutely. It's about knowing the why behind the how.
Our mission today is to completely demystify a foundational Korean comfort food so that you can confidently approach making it yourself. No matter where you live or what's in your local grocery store, we're talking about mandugook.
Just saying the name feels comforting, honestly.
It really does.
But before we get into the kitchen chemistry, let's make sure we have the basics down. The pronunciation is pretty straightforward. It's mandugook.
Mandugook. And if you're hunting around online for inspiration or recipe variations, you'll often see the romanized spelling as M-A-N-D-U-T-G-U-K, manduk.
Right, with that T in the middle.
Yeah. Though, honestly, if you're searching in English, the search hint is beautifully simple. You just search for dumpling soup. Or, I mean, if you happen to be cooking in a Spanish-speaking region, you can just translate it directly to sopa de dumplings.
The translation is simple, sure. But as we're about to see, the actual process requires you to completely rethink how you approach making soup.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to start a cooking project, you need to know what you're actually committing to.
You need ground rules.
Right. You need to know if you're making a chaotic, you know, 10-minute instant noodle fix at midnight, or if you're signing up for an 18-hour smoked brisket that needs you to babysit a fire all night.
Yeah, those are very different weekends.
Totally. So for mandugook, our source material gives us an estimated cooking time of about 50 minutes.
That 50-minute window is a really fascinating constraint. I mean, it's essentially the exact length of a prestige TV drama episode.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it.
Right. It's a very deliberate focus pocket of time. It's not a quick fix, but it's not an all-day affair either.
But here's what I found really intriguing when looking at the specific techniques required for this. Mandugook is classified squarely as a medium difficulty recipe.
Yes, which surprises a lot of people.
It surprised me, because usually when we think of soup, we think of this incredibly forgiving, free-form jazz approach. You toss whatever wilting vegetables you have into a pot.
Snag some water, yeah.
Let it simmer and just assume it'll magically work out. If mandugook is essentially just boiling dumplings in broth, why does it jump up to that medium difficulty tier rather than just being an easy entry-level dish?
Well, that soup is jazz mentality is exactly where a lot of home cooks get tripped up with this specific dish.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. The medium label doesn't come from a laundry list of complicated Michelin star techniques.
I mean, yeah,
you aren't flambéing anything and you aren't tempering chocolate.
Right.
The difficulty comes entirely from thermal management and timing.
Thermal management. Okay, so we're talking about controlling the boil.
Precisely. Making mandugook is about achieving a very fragile balance in that 50-minute window. You can't just throw your ingredients into a pot, crank the heat to high, walk away to watch that TV episode, and expect to come back to a finished meal.
So no passive cooking here.
No, you are actively managing the temperature of the broth. You have to carefully introduce the dumplings so the water temperature doesn't drop too drastically, and then monitor the simmer.
To make sure they cook through.
Yeah, to make sure they cook through without experiencing violent agitation from a rolling boil. It requires your active, undivided presence at the stove.
Wow. Okay, so you're acting as the conductor for those 50 minutes. You cannot leave the podium.
Exactly.
And managing that window isn't just about avoiding a culinary disaster. It's about hitting a very specific and perhaps surprising sensory target.
Because if you don't understand the target profile, you won't know if your technique actually worked when the timer goes off.
Right. And the flavor profile of mandu guk is decidedly, emphatically mild.
Very mild.
It is explicitly not spicy, which brings us back to that misconception we mentioned earlier. When a lot of people outside Korea think of Korean food, their minds jump to those intensely spicy, boldly flavored dishes.
The ones heavily spiced with gochugaru, those vibrant Korean red chili flakes.
Exactly. So if we are completely stripping away the gochugaru and the heavy spices, I have to ask, how do we prevent this from just tasting like bland hot water?
What's fascinating here is that to understand that, we have to look at the foundational philosophy of Korean dining.
Okay, tell me more.
Gentle, comforting soups aren't an afterthought in this cuisine. They are the absolute backbone. If you're eating a meal that features a brilliantly spicy, bold stew or, you know, rich fermented kimchi, your palate experiences a lot of fatigue.
Oh, I see. So you need a break.
Exactly. A mild soup like mandu guk serves as a perfectly seasoned, subtle canvas. It's designed specifically to soothe.
I really love that analogy of the broth acting as a canvas. The broth isn't trying to be the star of the show. It's stepping back to highlight something else entirely.
And that something else is the defining physical characteristic of the dish. It's the specific, delicate texture of the dumplings resting in that soup.
Ah, the texture.
Right. If the broth were aggressively spicy or packed with overpowering complex flavors, it would completely overshadow the sensory experience of biting into a perfectly cooked dumpling.
That makes total sense.
The mildness is entirely deliberate. It provides a clean backdrop so that the texture of the dumpling wrapper and the savory filling become the focal point of the entire bowl.
Which honestly makes the ingredient list we're working with even more of a puzzle. Because if we know that a clean, mild flavor and a delicate dumpling texture are the ultimate goals, we have to look at how we build that canvas.
And the source pack gives us some very strict parameters there.
Yeah, and I'll admit, the specific dietary profile for this dish challenges a lot of assumptions about how to build deep flavor in a soup.
It's a major departure from the heavy, meat-laden dumpling soups you might find in a lot of commercial restaurant settings.
So the profile we're breaking down today contains absolutely no pork, no beef, no chicken, and no seafood in its base.
None at all. That is a clean sweep of the traditional savory suspects.
Right. And usually, home cooks rely on simmering bones or dried anchovies for hours to extract those rich compounds.
Yeah, that's the standard playbook.
So if you're trying to build a hearty, comforting soup without any of those traditional meat bases, it sounds, well, a bit daunting. That feels like trying to build a house without bricks.
It can definitely feel that way at first glance.
But at the same time, the source explicitly embraces vegetarian substitutions. It gives a massive green light to plant-based workarounds. So how does a home cook outside of Korea actually make this work?
Well, it comes down to understanding how to harness plant-based umami.
Okay.
You don't need a heavy beef shank to create savoriness. You can build an incredibly complex yet mild base using things like dried kelp, shiitake mushrooms, or even just a very careful balance of aromatics.
Like garlic and onions.
Yeah, garlic and green onion, finished with a touch of good quality soy sauce.
So it's about coaxing flavor out of subtle ingredients, rather than just hammering the palate with heavy animal fats.
Exactly. And that's what makes this specific dietary profile so liberating for the global home cook.
Liberating. How so?
Because by not rigidly demanding specific cuts of pork or hard-to-source dried Korean seafood, the dish becomes infinitely adaptable. You're empowered to look at what you have available in your local grocery store.
Right, whether you're in a small town in Europe or a city in South America.
Exactly. You can use practical vegetarian substitutions to build that mild broth and the dumpling filling without worrying that you're doing something wrong.
So you aren't violating the cultural spirit of the dish by leaving the meat out?
Not at all. By focusing on a clean, mild, carefully balanced vegetarian base, you're arguably getting much closer to the pure, comforting essence of what a traditional Korean soup is supposed to be.
Rather than just relying on a heavy, one-note meat broth.
Exactly. You're using your local tools to execute a Korean culinary philosophy.
But, and this is a big but, there is one major structural constraint we have to talk about. Because while the broth and the filling are highly adaptable, our source flags one specific allergen that you absolutely cannot ignore.
Yes.
Wheat.
Wheat. That wheat tag is the single most important clue to the entire dish.
Mm-hmm.
Because the broth is meatless and highly adaptable, the wheat allergen clearly points to one thing.
The dumpling wrapper.
Exactly.
The wrappers.
And this brings us right back to why this dish earns its medium difficulty rating.
Mm-hmm.
We have this beautiful, adaptable, mild vegetarian broth. We have a 50-minute window, and we have these delicate wheat wrappers.
It's a delicate balancing act.
Yeah, because when you combine the freedom of using local overseas cooking alternatives with the structural fragility of wheat, you create the perfect environment for some very common, very disastrous mistakes.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, freedom in the kitchen always requires discipline to execute properly.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
And the biggest pitfall for a home cook making mandugak outside of Korea is the mismanagement of the boiling process. Let's break down the food science of what actually happens when this goes wrong. Because when you're using practical substitutions, say you couldn't find traditional Korean mandu wrappers, so you bought wonton wrappers or Japanese gyoza wrappers at your local supermarket.
Which is completely fine to do, by the way.
Right, but they are going to behave differently in the water.
Exactly. They might have a different thickness or a completely different ratio of starch to gluten compared to a traditional wrapper.
And that changes the hydration mechanics.
Right. When a wheat wrapper hits boiling water, the starches immediately begin to absorb liquid and swell. This is called gelatinization.
Gelatinization. Okay.
It's what makes the wrapper turn from a brittle, dry disc into a soft, silky, edible texture.
But there's a tipping point.
A very steep tipping point.
Mm.
If you mismanage your timer, if you overcook those store-bought wrappers even by 2 or 3 minutes, the starch matrix essentially acts like a sponge that has taken on too much water.
Oh.
Yeah, it loses its structural integrity. The gluten network collapses. The wrapper turns into absolute mush. And eventually, the dumpling just tears open right there in the pot.
And when that wrapper bursts, it's not just a visual issue, right? It creates this catastrophic cascade effect for the entire dish.
It completely ruins the core concept we just spent so much time discussing.
Because you carefully crafted this perfectly balanced, mild, clear, vegetarian canvas of a broth.
And the moment that dumpling explodes, it spills all its filling into the liquid. And worse, all that excess starch from the disintegrated wrapper leaches into the water.
So your elegant, clear soup suddenly turns into a murky, cloudy, starchy porridge.
Exactly. You've completely lost the delicate texture of the wrapper, which is supposed to be the star of the show, and you've destroyed the mild clarity of the soup.
That is tragic.
It is. That's why the practical substitutions outside Korea are encouraged, but they come with a major warning. You can use whatever vegetarian fillings and local broths you want, but you must remain hyper-focused on preserving that core textural experience.
So it's an exercise in extreme mindfulness. You really have to watch those dumplings like a hawk.
You do.
You have to manage the heat so it's a gentle simmer, not a violent rolling boil that knocks the dumplings around.
Right. No violent agitation.
And you have to pull them off the heat the exact second they are cooked through, making sure the wrapper is silky and resilient, not mushy and broken.
It demands your respect for that entire 50-minute window.
Yeah.
But I have to say, when you get it right, it's incredibly rewarding.
I can imagine.
Yeah, looking down at a bowl of perfectly clear, mild broth with beautiful, intact dumplings resting at the bottom, it's a real testament to your technique.
So what does this all mean? Let's step back and look at the whole picture of what mandugak actually teaches us.
Okay.
We started this deep dive trying to demystify a classic dish for the curious home cook. And what we found wasn't a rigid, intimidating set of foreign culinary laws. We found a highly adaptable, beautifully designed framework.
It completely reframes how you might think about Korean cuisine, doesn't it?
It really does. It proves that you don't always need fire, spice, or hard-to-find meats to experience deep, traditional comfort.
Not at all. It relies on mastering technique over tracking down exotic ingredients.
Right. It's about understanding the food science of wheat wrappers, managing a gentle simmer, and coaxing complex flavors out of practical vegetarian substitutions to build a gentle, clear broth.
You're learning the underlying philosophy of the dish
Yeah.
rather than just blindly following a rigid list of ingredients.
Because it all comes down to intent. The intent to create a soothing canvas that perfectly highlights a delicate texture.
Exactly.
Which brings up a really fascinating concept. I want you, the listener, to mull over the next time you step into your kitchen to cook something new. We just outlined how a traditional Korean dish like mandugak can completely omit traditional meats.
Right.
We discussed how it practically encourages utilizing local vegetarian substitutes from a grocery store halfway across the world, whether that's mushrooms from a market in Madrid or kelp from a shop in Ohio. And yet, if you execute it with the right intent, managing that 50-minute window and nailing that textural balance, it completely retains its cultural identity as a comforting Korean soup.
It really forces you to ask, what makes a recipe truly authentic?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, is authenticity strictly bound by the exact geographical origin of the ingredients in the pot? Does a dish lose its cultural identity just because the wrapper came from a different aisle or because you used a local vegetable broth instead of a traditional meat base?
It's a heavy question.
Or is true authenticity found in the technique, the specific texture, and the feeling that the cook creates in the bowl?
It's such a great question to end on. Because when you're standing over that stove, carefully managing the heat to cradle those delicate wheat wrappers, ensuring the broth remains a perfect, mild canvas, you aren't just boiling water. You're capturing the authentic soul of the dish, no matter where in the world your kitchen happens to be.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.